Blog Talk Radio.
What's happening, everybody? This is me. That's the music right there. Hey, what's happening, everybody? Once again, this is the hour, the 8 o'clock hour on a Wednesday evening, 8 to 9 p.m., and you are listening to the Kay Thompson Live Show. I am commonly known as the Son, also known as Citizen Payne. My mom, Kay Thompson, the legendary Kay Thompson, is feeling a little bit under the weather, today is the 4th of April, 2018. And it is the 50th anniversary of the death of Martin Luther King, Jr. We're going to be talking about that, definitely. If you want to, we're going to be talking about that, the death of Dr. King. Obviously, we have to give homage to one of the greatest leaders that the world has ever known. It's ironic now that we have this person that is in office that clearly doesn't deserve to be in office, clearly probably doesn't even deserve to mention Dr. King in his mouth, and who is one of those, you know, since we've been leading up to the events marking today's anniversary, Dr. King, I'm sorry, everybody, just turning down my devices here, but like I was saying, up until today, you know, I've been seeing a lot of footage, you know, a lot of those black and white footage, the George Wallace footage standing in the doorway of the school, the Orville Faubus, you know, all this stuff, these guys. And it's just ironic now that we are, in fact, dealing with a president who reminds us of those days. It certainly has gone to the trouble of showing all of the divisions in our country and kind of fanning those flames that were once very prevalent in this country. And certainly this guy has absolutely done everything, taken every low road he could possibly have taken to bring some of those feelings back to the forefront in the United States of America. And Trump is no good, if you ask me. That's just my personal opinion there, ladies and gentlemen. But I'm going to bring in one of our co-hosts now, Brother Byron Saunders. Brother Byron, how are you this evening?
Well, on this day, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the assassination of another Prince of Peace, my remembrances of the place and time where I was, events that followed afterwards, growing up in Washington, D.C., remembering the riots that took place and all that my family involved in trying to help those who were displaced by the riots in Washington, D.C., and also remembering on Easter Sunday after the riots, we had a 4 p.m. curfew in Washington, D.C., surrounded by National Guard. That's what Washington, D.C. was, shut down totally, if you can only imagine that. News blackouts, people rioting in the streets. And so my good friend Eric and my prayers are for your mom for a quick and speedy recovery. But I also have to remind the rest of the world listening and tuning in to us that on this day, the day the earth stood still, the day our Prince of Peace was killed. My heart was broken, Eric. I can't tell you any other words, and it still moves me. As last Monday, which was my birthday, and I was at Riverside Cathedral for the playing of the new HBO film, a documentary on Dr. King, King in the Wilderness, and the church was packed, Eric, with the who's who of everybody you can imagine, from even my dear friend who I hadn't seen in years, Zernona Clayton, who was the person who drove Martin Luther King to the airport before he went to Memphis that night, that day before. And to see my friends that I hadn't seen in years and listening almost to a pin drop at certain moments in the documentary. It's on HBO TV now, and I really encourage everybody to watch it. White, black, it doesn't matter, because we don't know Martin other than the speech, "I Have a Dream," but to know his life 18 months before he died, it just takes you there. I cried. I boo-hooed, even in the church. And I was watching it last night and, you know, going to the ceremonies, living in Atlanta, and my friends, the King family, and Andy Young, these are personal friends of mine. And knowing at each of these April 4th and listening to them and celebrating and the remembrance. It's kind of hard to celebrate when your Prince of Peace has been killed. But here we are, 2018, and as you said, we have a person in the White House who has no respect for people or men or women or races of color. He has none, absolutely none. And so what are we going to do in the new movement, Eric? You and I are part of the new movement. Those kids in Washington, D.C. a couple weeks ago, over 1 million people participating in a worldwide march, and seeing the granddaughter of Martin Luther King Jr. take her place at center stage, having that dream fulfilled, not the next generation, but three generations removed, to his granddaughter having her moment in the spotlight. That was the realization of the dream right there. So here we are on this special day.
Right, and I certainly agree. I certainly agree that that's it. I mean, it's just devastating here. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to get some things happening here.
No problem.
But I certainly agree. I certainly agree that that there's some things there about Dr. King. I personally let's go to Wayne Gilman. I'm sorry. Trying to get 8 million things happening here. Here's our other co-host, Mr. Wayne Gilman. Let's open up your mic. Hey, Wayne, how you doing this evening?
Hey, good evening, everyone. And it's certainly, you know, I hate to even sound maudlin behind, you know, the comments that Byron just gave. You know, it takes me back.
Wayne, we got a real bad connection. Can you call
can
us
you
right
hear
back?
Me?
I don't. Do you hear? It's really bad.
Yeah,
hear that, Byron? It sounds bad on your.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bad connection. Just call
it
back.
Okay, I'll try calling you back.
Yeah, call right back.
Definitely. All right. So, yeah, Eric, you know, where were you when King was assassinated? What in your life, what were you doing on that?
I was 8 years old, brother. So I don't really remember where I was. I probably was in Newark, New Jersey, at our home. Let me do a use the marvel of the internet to see exactly what day that was. You know, we could do that now.
Exactly. But I
believe
it was
April 4th,
19th. It was a Wednesday.
Was it a Thursday?
Yeah, 1968. It was April 4th, 1968, you know, and wow.
It was a Thursday.
Just a
day. That's interesting.
Yeah, I believe it was a Thursday. It might have been a Wednesday.
You're right. It was a Thursday, and you know, I saw an interview with this woman.
Yeah.
Let's go. Okay, we got Wayne calling back again. Let's see if we got a little better connection. Wayne, got you back on.
Hi. Is this any better?
Not much.
Okay. You know, we had storm damage over here, and I think that's largely the problem. Because even on the cell,
right.
I can't even get a. Maybe I'll try you on that to see if that makes a difference.
If you could try, you're calling from a landline now.
I'm calling from
now.
A landline because I didn't want the interruption with the cell. But you know, this is storm related, I guess. That's my problem.
Yeah, it sounds like you're underwater in and it's skipping a little bit. Try back from the.
Yeah, he's underwater.
Yeah.
I am. All right.
All right.
If you don't hear back from me, I'm sorry about that, but I'll try to figure something out.
All right. All right. Thanks.
Okay.
Bye.
You know, Eric, while we're waiting for...
It was a Thursday.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, just to finish, it was a Thursday, and I was probably at home, and I don't... Just after 6 p.m., he was fairly shot. So if Memphis is a little bit of a time difference, I guess, maybe an hour, maybe they're a Central Standard Time. But I probably was at home, you know, in the evening watching some TV or whatever. I can remember, and I've said this before, that after the death of Dr. King, I can remember going on a march with my parents in Newark. I can also remember being in this Newark Symphony Hall I don't know if this was before or after Dr. King's assassination, but I can remember watching that documentary that they did back then about the civil rights movement, you know, the Freedom Riders and the kids getting, you know, because if you remember, Byron, that was a documentary that came out actually while the movement was still happening, right, while they were still protesting.
Yeah.
The movement was still going on. Like I said, I don't remember if it was Dr. King pre his assassination or not, but I can remember being in this documentary with my parents, screening of this documentary. Apparently it was kind of major because it had just been done about the movement. And I can remember that everybody had to leave. The lights came on and everybody was asked to leave because there was a bomb threat called in to there that night. And I'd have to kind of try and refresh my mother and father's memory, but I kind of remember that happening and having to leave out of there. And then the riots ensued in Newark, and we were shipped to Elizabeth, not shipped because Elizabeth was really kind of two towns over, next town over really in Newark, where we were staying with our grandparents. But my father talks about, you know, my father was, and he was in the Star Ledger on Sunday. They did an article about Dr. King, and on the front page of the Sunday Star Ledger is when Dr. King came to Weequahic High School in Newark, New Jersey. The Sunday Star Ledger, it's called Memories of King. And my father's on inside, a picture of him, and he's been interviewed. But on the front cover, you see Dr. King speaking to the students at Weequahic High School. And anybody who's listening, if you look at the lower left-hand corner of the picture, you'll see my uncle, a young Congressman Donald Payne with a teacher friend of his that he called up to see if he wanted to go see Dr. King that afternoon. And it's just when you look back at that bit of history and seeing my uncle, who will become the first African-American from the state of New Jersey, first African-American, I believe, elected on a federal level from the state of New Jersey.
Right.
All of those years ago, he would later be that his where his history would end up to lead. But my father was a youth president of the youth chapter of the NAACP, and that's how he came to know Dr. King. And his story is that, you know, Dr. King, you know, he introduced Dr. King at the convention in San Francisco, I think maybe in 56, and that's how they met, and they became friendly, I believe. And my father tells this story, and a lot of people in the area know of my father having a certain temperament. And it's because the passion that he instills, because the men like Dr. King and Malcolm X and Medgar Evers that he met, and he says, this is the least I can do, you know, to be passionate, to maintain this passion about these issues, because these men gave their life. So the least I can do, my father says, is to be passionate. If anybody can want to go see that on YouTube, click in Bill Payne on YouTube. You type that in and say, the least I can do is the title of the clip that I cut of my father at a speaking engagement describing of this situation. He talks about the last time he saw Dr. King. Dr. King visited Newark, made a stop in Newark, and my father had double parked at the venue, ran in to see Dr. King, and on the way out he was talking to Dr. King, and he said, well, Bill, why don't you come over to New York? I got to go to Harry's house, Harry Belafonte's house, for an event. Why don't you come with me? And my father said, you know, Dr. King, I'm double parked here. I got the kids. And there was a Newark police officer that was driving Dr. King at the time that knew my father and said, you know, Bill, I'll bring you back if you want to leave the car. And my father's like, no, you know, I got my wife and the kids. I got to go home. Dr. Dr. King, I will see you next time. And the last image that he remembers of Dr. King is Dr. King waving at him out the back of the window. And a couple of weeks later, his friend Dr. King, Martin Luther King, was assassinated. So that's why my father is the way that he is.
Yes. What's really important is that we hear these stories. You see, because our perspective of King is filtered.
And how many people
filtered.
Have them over the, all around the country, too, Byron? How many
exactly.
people have those stories around
exactly.
the country? And I would love to hear every single one. So if anybody's listening
exactly.
to us and you have some Dr. King stories or even like a in passing, we'd love to hear those. Call us and tell us about it.
It's
so the number 323-679-0906, 323-679-0906 if you want to chime in or mention that if you have a family member. A lot of us are, you know, are younger now, so maybe they have a family member, a grandfather or a father or an aunt or uncle that might have had one of these real life experiences
exactly.
with Dr. King and also with the movement. You were going to say, Byron?
Right. I was just going to say that to hear these first person stories relative to an event that had such an impact on not just a region or a city or even a small community, but this had an impact on a nation and the global community.
Right.
So big
right.
that when we don't have these stories retold in a manner in which it allows us both, it's very cathartic to get them out, but it also connects us. And when we don't have these stories told in any fashion or form or manner, it's like almost like there's a total disconnect from the millennials to the baby boomers to the because they don't understand that we are part of this global community. And when someone like a Martin Luther King or a Gandhi or Kennedy or Malcolm X is assassinated, and you have to remember, this is what our nation went through back in the early 60s of losing JFK, Bobby Kennedy. I mean, I shook Bobby Kennedy's hand 2 weeks before he was assassinated. My remembrances of the March on Washington is that I was 13 years old. And my dad, I wanted to go down with my father to the march, and all my aunts and relatives and uncles who came from across the country to go and participate on the March on Washington. And my dad said to me, he said, "Son, I know you want to come with me, but you're the only male child in this household. And if something should happen to me and your aunts and uncles, I need you to protect your mom and your sisters." On that day, Terry, I grew up. I became a man. And my mother walked us up to Rhode Island Avenue from where we were living, close by, which is Route 1. We watched the people come in by bus, bicycle, caravans, horse-drawn wagons, mule-drawn wagons. People were walking. We even saw people roller skating in to Washington, D.C. And after that march, we went back home and anxiously waited for my father and my aunts and uncles to come home. And it was like the best moments I ever had as a fly on the wall, listening to all that took place down at the mall to hear their first-person experiences. And then, of course, years later, when in 1968, when King was assassinated, I remember it so well because that next day I'm in high school, I'm a senior, and I go to school and I'm in a Catholic military academy in Washington, D.C. And ultimately we get over the loudspeaker like about 10 o'clock in the morning. We're letting everybody out in school. And, you know, there's only about 65 black kids and about 300 white young men in all boys military academy. And they were saying, "Please, if you got to go from here to Virginia, do not go down Georgia Avenue or 14th Street because there's a disturbance, there are riots going on in Washington, and we don't want anything to happen to any of our students." Let me tell you, Eric, my father was working at the State Department at that time, and I called him to let him know there was a riot going on because he did not know the whole city was under a news blackout. And I had to go pick him up from the State Department and take a circuitous route, avoiding the known areas where the riots were taking place, so I could get him back to our home safe and secure. So it's those moments and these stories, like the one you're telling, the one I'm telling, I'm sure Wayne as a
right.
as a news director has plenty of stories. But when we don't have
right,
these stories
sure.
told, look at the disconnect it has for people who can't believe that the civil rights movement was actually functioning and winning. We
right.
shall
I mean,
overcome
became
we were overcoming. Absolutely.
Yeah, and there's a whole generation now that doesn't get the severity or the weight of these instances that happened. You know, our generation, as you pointed out,
yeah.
I'm a little younger than you guys, but everybody in my generation really are the last, I think, generation, maybe a little bit younger, maybe a couple of my sister's age, my sister Lisa or Gina, probably the last
yeah.
generation that really can tell you and feel the effect firsthand
absolutely.
Of Dr.
Yes.
King and that effect and that time period. Those of us that were alive even a little bit during the 60s remember that, and even the early 70s remember the effect that his presence had on this country and had on us as African-American people. And that must have been a glorious day for you to stand there and see. Those are the stories I want to know.
Yeah.
The young guy named Byron Saunders who stands on the side and watches the people go by. That's the movie right there. That's the average
that's
everyday.
That's the movie.
You know,
exactly.
a lot of times when they make these movies, they make them about these individuals who are a part of these events, these larger-than-life events. And sometimes in these movies, we lose sight of the average everyday person. You know, that average everyday African-American person who wasn't so active, you wouldn't remember them. They wouldn't be listed in the annals of history as members of the civil rights movement, but there are millions and hundreds and thousands of black people who participated just by every day going to work and showing up and showing that we were contributing individuals and members of this society. You know, this is why when I hear people talking about the greatest generation, I'm like, okay,
right.
I understand you want to say that, but I got to, if this is going to be a democratic society, then we should at least have a vote,
right.
or at least allow us to place into a nomination of our considerations, our thoughts of who's the greatest generation. Because usually the generation, you learn your history from the previous generation that usually brought you into the world,
yeah.
right? The generation
that
brought you up. So for me, my history is affected by that generation that immediately brought me into the world, the generation of my parents and that. So therefore, the generation that I see as being one of the greatest or certainly should go into the nomination for voting at least is that civil rights generation in my perspective. If you want to talk about the greatest
yeah.
generation, that generation that was met with these challenges at this time, at this vortex, when things came together and it was a time and place and all of these things corresponded at the right time to create this perfect storm of what we had to do and how our people had to work to move forward. But I think that generation
yeah.
that knew that they were going to be clubbed in the head and still had the courage
yeah.
to sit there and wait for that thing, or John Lewis, this great man who was in my presence. So every single time I get a chance to be in his presence, I remember what he sacrificed and what he put on the line
yeah.
when he crossed that bridge and was one of the first and leading that march and almost came to death
that's
that
right.
day.
I'm in greatness
whenever I'm in this humble, great man's presence. So when people want to talk about
yeah.
the greatest generation, and they often want to highlight that generation and one ethnic group of that generation, because, you know, my Uncle John fought in World War II too, you know, when they
right.
had a lot of these
right.
black veterans that didn't get the respect or didn't get the highlight that they had, that Saving Private Ryan folks have. You know, there was a whole bunch
right.
of black vets that were fighting there too, but that's another story. But if you're going to talk about the nominations for greatest generation, for me, at least humbly include the civil rights generation. Because certainly,
and you know,
the other
thing, Eric, that was important, that generation took the civil rights movement so seriously. They dressed up in shirt and ties.
Mm-hmm.
They went to it like
yes,
it was a
sir.
Formal event. Who does that, Derek? Come on,
mm-hmm.
my brother. We're talking about not showing up in your pants hanging by your knees. No, dressing like you were going to church because they were in service of a spiritual appointment with God and freedom. That went together.
That's right.
And
That's right.
And to understand and really comprehend that is to really acknowledge, even when he was assassinated, he was on his way to a dinner at another preacher's house who that morning said that they were invited to come over that night, and he was chastising chastising Jesse Jackson to wear a shirt and tie to the dinner. That's incredible. Think about that. Then in the documentary, it showed the night before when he went to the church to deliver "I've Been to the Mountaintop" speech. He was in his pajamas, and it was pouring down raining. And Jesse called him and said, "Martin, you need to come over here. The church is three quarters full, and they just need to come by and say hello." That speech was not part of a speech that he kind of just wrote out. He gave that extemporaneously. That's incredible.
That's something I never knew. That is remarkable.
Oh, that is remarkable. And that speech was almost the point of which that morning they had a pillow fight. The evening that he got killed. That morning, he and Jesse and Ralph.
Andy
had a pillow fight, acting like 10
right.
year olds.
They talk about that.
Just being
that's kind of a part of the documentary that you hear when you hear Andy Young talking. Because Andy Young, one of them didn't report in. They didn't report to let them know that they were okay. You know, that's part of the prophecy. You know, I've often believed when I watched Dr. King that he was received a prophecy that his life, that was going to happen. Because you look at what he's saying and how he's saying it. And just now that you tell me that was extemporaneous, that makes it even more of a prophecy that this had been on his mind, that God had visited him, that he received some type of message that his life was coming to an end here on this planet Earth, that he knew that time was short somewhere along the times. And if you know anything about how they did the COINTELPRO program, certainly if you watched Malcolm X, you know, it was brought home to me being in that movie, but how the forces, J. Edgar Hoover's forces and these other demonic forces and evil forces would be calling Dr. King up, you know, calling his house like they did Malcolm, called their house and just do that psychological warfare on them, you know?
Exactly.
And so you understand that these things were going on in his mind at the time and that he was visited. He was protected.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
And just the fact you say it's extemporaneous, this speech is extemporaneous, and he made it off the top of his head, that means it was foremost on his mind that these things were coming through, you know?
Oh, my God.
Now, 50 years later, where we're at, and I just want to address what we're talking about, how people presented themselves, you know? The entire race knew there was a way that we needed to present ourselves. And I understand at that time that was definitely a part of freedom, so to speak, that we are ready to take care of business, be productive members of society. But I don't want that to negate the way some of our people dress now, because some of them that are part of the movement, Black Lives Movement, are picking up the mantle. They don't necessarily, you know, they don't necessarily come with that type of that mentality in terms of letting dress and attire specifically designate their thoughts and where they're coming from. You know, let's not write off the brother wearing a hat as just being a thug because he's wearing it a certain way, because a lot of those times, a lot of those cats like Chuck D and them were very educated, you know, and the music they were popping off might have sounded like the popular music of the day and just to say something, but if you listen to Public Enemy, there's a mission that they're talking about. And there's a way that the brothers dress for a certain reason, because we mean business. And it's going to come a time when we mean business again. But you got to understand, too, when these people are willing to turn weapons on you, and the way they, you know, if you look at the news now, look at a lot of these clips, you would think that the white guys like to shoot black guys, that these white cops like to shoot black guys just on GP. You know, I saw something recently on Facebook the other day about these guys shooting a guy in a wheelchair in Maryland a year ago that just now coming out. Gunning the brother down in a wheelchair. So and it made me also think of the woman in Oklahoma when the brother was walking back to his car and she just shot. They seem not to have no compassion. They seem not to look at us as human beings. I've said this before. In order for you to treat somebody with subhuman, treat them with subhuman actions, you have to look at them as being subhuman, not being a species of warranted compassion.
Right.
So that's where the hatred comes
right.
from. You know, the civil rights
and then not,
the voter isn't you,
right.
you would, no, I was going to say you would notice, Brian.
And then,
the voting
and then
rights
not
act,
looking
right,
at
the voter.
Yes, yes. And see, and the thing that's really painful is they're not recognizing it today like it was back then. Oh, it's only a local issue. It's a state's rights issue. This is a national disease that is ongoing in our country, and for 50 years it has been metastasizing like cancer, and it is about to explode. That's
mm-hmm.
the fear that we have because it's like it's not stopping every day. We're seeing somebody in a tragedy. Somebody's getting killed by a gun. Another black man has been killed, and there are black women who go missing that nobody is talking about. We have
mm-hmm.
a serious, serious national issue, and when you marginalize it to only indicate from the pulpit itself of the White House to say it's only a local initiative, a local problem. I have no respect for that office, none. But in the meantime, your focus is on paying $130,000 to get laid by one woman and another $150,000 that you had an intimate relationship with, and your morals are perverted. Let's just call it what it is, because I'm sick and tired of hearing about that kind of perversion, when on the other side of the coin, today we celebrate the 50th anniversary of someone killed who stood up in formal wear for the rights of people. That
stood up for something.
Diametrically opposed. Stood up for something,
mm-hmm.
Eric. And we are, the baton has been passed to us. And I'm very happy to say that of the last 3 years, we've had more conversations now about race than we had in the last 30 years. Think about that.
Right.
And it's not because mm-hmm. of the riot that took place. It was, and we didn't even initiate it, but I can guarantee you this, that next explosion, because we came very close to one out there in San Diego, or was Sacramento rather, with the young man getting shot 21 times. How do you shoot somebody 21 times when not one of those bullets is one of that can be considered as premeditated murder? You can't.
You can when you run the system, and when the system has
That's
a different
right.
mission than what they say their mission is. Now they're saying what
exactly.
their mission, their public statement, their PR statement says one thing, but it appears that their mission is a little bit different. And somebody told me, I don't know who it was, that they were working somewhere, and they were working somewhere where some skinhead dude was saying, and a skinhead dude that said to the person, "You don't even understand. There's so many skinheads that are joining police forces right now with the sole intent to murder black people," which is really nothing new. I don't know why he thought that was news. That seems
right.
to me to be the way it's been going on for years. That ain't nothing new.
Thank you.
You know?
Thank you.
Let me
ask you a question, Eric, because you are a very knowledgeable African-American male. We have an investigation that's ongoing to determine if there was collusion. Do you, by your acknowledgement of the information that you've picked up in bits and pieces, because it's not been one level story about it, but in your opinion, was there collusion? In your opinion, has there been obstruction of justice? In your opinion, I mean, it's not like we don't know enough of the information, but those deniers, like the ones who are denying climate change, it's like denying the obvious. And then we're trying to convince you that you have your intellect and your moments of observation, which you have been trained to use, because your education has given you this moments to understand by observation the truth, okay? So do you really need Mueller to tell you that there was you know what I'm saying? Is that the point at which I can tell you how much
collusion? I'll go back to the old saying that everybody says, don't piss on my head and tell me it's raining. Let me just break it down like that.
Tell me it's raining. It's not raining. That's right.
Clearly, what's clear is that there's a plan in effect, right? It's clearly obvious. I mean, if you break it down, if you pay attention to things, there can be no other conclusion that one could come to. If this despicable individual gets elected after one of the most highly integrity having individuals was elected president, first black president, but a moral center that this guy had, even though people want to say he didn't do nothing for black people and all this idiotic stuff, I don't know why we always want to find a way to denigrate each other. But, you know, if you look at just the person, the individual, and then the individual that they chose to follow up, it's as if people said, those people that chose this man to be in this space, it's as if they wanted to say, screw you people, screw you to the ninth degree, because we're going to elect the most vile, the most just despicable, hateful individual, divisive individual, because what he does is promote our agenda of white supremacy. That's the only thing that I could think of why you would want to vote for this guy. After hearing him speak and hearing him talk, and certainly to me, I just am turned off by a person who talks about themselves so much. I am leery of someone who talks about how great they are and everything they've done. But my objective is a little bit different. My objective is just trying to find the best person for the job. My objective is not, let me find the person who's saying the most extreme stuff and is going to make the people, my people and people that look like me and agree with me, supreme over everybody else. Because there's a, you know, we both know that America was founded on, what America says it was founded on is not really what it was founded on, is it? It was founded for a certain reason, for a certain group of people, or at least this version of America was conquered for a certain group of people. And clearly the way this country ended up being developed, surely there were other people in that mix who were true human beings and saw the humanity of all human beings, but the majority of people in that mix had a certain perspective and a certain objective, was to say, this is going to be our nation for our purposes, our needs, and people that look like us and anybody else who looks different will either murder them off the land or make them our slaves. And clearly that must be the objective, because if you see how these individuals are acting now, this man lies every day, all day long, and it's okay with them. He started out disrespecting a whole other ethnic group, and that's okay with them. They can live with that.
Yeah.
So that tells me that these individuals, they're all in accordance with a certain objective and a certain way that they want to see America develop and live. And that is that they are first-class citizens and everybody else is beneath them. I mean, clearly, that's clearly your objective. If you go along with all of this madness, if you guys are supposed to be elected representatives of the people, and this man is so despicable, so disgusting to every individual that he decides to have a disagreement with, even your own, and you're still willing to take that just so long as you achieve that one objective. And clearly, to me, that only objective can only be that let's make America back to where it was in the 50s.
Right? Yeah.
And that facade for people who want to be a part of the certain ethnic group that they feel supreme, and they'll just get fooled again. That's the biggest tragedy to me, is that these people think that this guy really is concerned about them and that he really wants to help them, and and they just pimp these people's prejudices, you know?
Right.
And it's unbelievable that they don't even care about their own, because it's not only black people that are poor. I've seen a lot of white people that are poor and are struggling and could use some help. But these people don't care about that. And some of the people in that very group, they don't care about themselves enough to say, hey, this guy's not for us. They're just listening to what he says. The heck with all those foreign, brown, non-people that look like us and you know. So, I mean, clearly their objective is to live that way. And everything else they claim and hide behind is good.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say that one of the things that's important about honoring today's date, April 4th, 1968, 50 years later, the assassination of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., is that he literally pivoted to his next campaign was the Poor People's Campaign.
Mm-hmm.
It was this because you may recall his speech at the Riverside Church a year before he was assassinated pivoted again from the Southern strategy to Vietnam. And mm-hmm. even the black ministers, his friends and Roy Wilkins and NAACP, told him, don't go after Vietnam. But his speech at Riverside was outlining and detailing that how could he be protesting the injustices in America to the brown people that in Mississippi and Chicago and all across the country in the United States of America and not include the brown people of Vietnam. He said it so clearly. And you have to remember, at that time, a year before his death, that's the pivot that he made. And then that call that came from Memphis brought him back down to Memphis at the time that he was green-lighting to go ahead and do the Poor People's Campaign, bringing white, black, Hispanic, Native Americans together to come in Washington, D.C., and shut it down intentionally to engage a conversation on Capitol Hill in the halls of the Capitol to talk about the poor people of America. And then, of course,
yep.
He went to Memphis, and we know the rest of the story, and he killed the dream. Mm-hmm. And even in that documentary on HBO, Jesse Jackson says, once he was killed, and Andy Young says it, once he was killed, then the civil rights movement was fractured. America
That's right.
exploded. It exploded in anger. For a man who purposely drove peace and love. And I remember Stokely Carmichael, because back in 1968, I first met Stokely Carmichael and H. Rap Brown when they were driving the campaign for the Black Student Union movement, because I was the representative for my black brothers at the Christian Brothers on Jesuit run military Catholic high school that I went to, and I remember going down to being invited by Stokely and H-Rap and even Marion Barry back in those days, 1968, to come down, because at that time H-Rap Brown and Stokely Carmichael were all part of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and many people don't know this, mm-hmm. Eric, that the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, also known as SNCC, was the actual militant wing of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
Mm-hmm.
People don't even know that history.
That whole situation going on between Stokely and Dr. King, you know.
Yeah.
Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, came to Hampton when I was in school.
Yeah.
And, he kind of has a tendency to rub people the wrong way sometimes if you don't disagree, if you don't agree with them. I've known a couple of friends who had discussions with Stokely, and he, you know, tries to go for your jugular a little bit. This particular one, he said that, made a statement about Dr. King, and he said Dr. King was right, Martin King was just that, but he was a fool. And why did he say that? Because a lot of those folks up there hopped up, and he was getting ready to lose the crowd then. But he was speaking from the knowledge of having worked with Dr. King, and he wanted to speak about Russia, you know, United States versus Russia, and then Russia, you could do this and that. And I had been to Russia the previous summer, mm-hmm. obviously being with the youth and government program, elected youth governor, and just a lot of the extracurricular things that I've been exposed to through my father, my uncle. I asked him a question. I said, you know, in Russia, they don't have this and that. And I knew that he was going to ask me, and he said, my brother, well, have you been to Russia? Knew that was coming. I kind of set him up. I was like, yeah. You know, I have been. And what you're talking about is not exactly correct. You know, I had to run out because my little shuttle was going back to my dorm apartment. But he was like, go to Africa, my brother, go to Africa. But I understood what he was saying at the time. But I had another friend. I met a Facebook friend who was a publicist out of Chicago, and she had a similar experience with Mr. Carmichael. But we understand that, as you pointed out, the movement got fractured, and there's a lot of different perspectives of for us how to move forward. And therein lies the rub, so to speak, for us as a nation and as a movement of people, because we need to kind of have certain basics of one accord. And, and you know, I can understand. I understand African Americans who might want to be Republican, you know, because we need to be in all aspects of society. Because I'm under the impression that meeting someone who you might get along with causes you not to have a negative or a preconceived notion of the entire group. So if some of these Republicans meet a black Republican who's a normal black person that could talk to, maybe they go and think, well, I met a black person and they're a Republican and there's no horns on their head and no tails. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm saying Republicans. Obviously, you might have some Republicans that might think that. You know, but I'm one who almost likes to say, you know, we need to be in all of these various areas. We need to have some people, as long as they're not co-signing, and Clarence Thomas and all these other people who bring up these points of view. Say, you know, like Michael Steele's gotten Michael Steele, former Republican national chair, has gotten a real wake-up call in terms of some of the treatment that he's received from his fellow Republicans. And being challenged the way he's been challenged. I saw him be challenged by the guy Matt Slapp or whatever he heavy set dude with the gray hair who challenged Michael Steele, saying you were, I think he was allegedly saying he got his chairmanship because he was African American, and he was just kind of dissing Michael Steele. I'm sure one could bring it up on YouTube, but it was an interesting exchange. If you know what I'm talking about, and it shows how little they respect him. They don't respect you. They're using you. I would suggest that they're using all people of color to as a way so they can secure those votes. And the ones they can't use, they're going to try and do what they're doing and restrict the right to vote and stop people's ability to have the right to vote, which is what they're doing in Texas. And that governor who was in North Carolina, and they call it voter ID or voter protection or whatever their lies they're telling about it, but that's what they're trying to do, you know?
Yeah.
And as we talk about these acts of violence against our people, you know, I think that Dr. King at the time probably saw that African Americans being a smaller percentage of the country and seeing what the establishment was willing to do to us if it really wanted to, in terms of rolling out National Guard and having armed troops on the streets, a violent revolution was not one that might have been the best tact, because you're talking about, I mean, in any revolution, you look at the casualties, right? And you look at, is this a revolution, if this is going to be a violent revolution or a revolution of violent means, what are our chances of winning? And when you don't have large chances of winning, then, you know, you have to rethink your strategy, and I think that that's a big real thing.
That was the challenge that Martin Luther King and Southern Christian Leadership Conference, whose perspective was based in nonviolent disobedience and based in a Christian doctrine of following in the footsteps of the Prince of Peace as a Christian. Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, although was in the beginning, had white and black. Stokely pretty much expelled all the white folks from SNCC, and it was at a time when Afrocentric movement was really running full steam ahead, so that the effort was that moment when Stokely uttered the words black power, it became the young person, the young Negro, the young African Americans, it became their MO. And you may recall at that time, black power then became I'm black and I'm proud. So that it was a movement of youthful people, very much like what's going on right now, but where the youth have said, you know, the hell with you adults. You baby boomers, y'all are the ones who got us in trouble, and now you got those young students who are not only just propelling an initiative that is part of the civil rights movement, but they have the courage, and it's mostly young whites from the movement that's from the Parkland School, but look how they've been able to bring into the conversation their African-American students from their school and around the country and saying, no, it's not just about us because we're affluent. Let's talk about the issues of gun violence in the urban communities and bring them to the same conversation. That's scaring the Republicans and the Trumps and the Democrats, who are all stuck. They're stuck, Eric, in a mindset that says status quo. They will do everything and anything possible to keep these young people and their voices to be muted. And they're hoping it just dies out. But it's not going to die out. And I have to remind people, I said, do you realize that it started on February 14th? And in 3 weeks' time, they were able to galvanize over 1 million people globally to be in protest? Eric, you know how long it took to get the Poor People's Campaign and the March on Washington together? That took more than a couple of years of advanced, preparation. These young people moved the mountain.
That's right.
Biblical.
Well, I mean, they're using the technology now to their advantage,
right?
And also from what you're telling me, I mean, you said this last week, I think a week before last, how they included the inner city and black and brown kids who are victims of gun violence. When you break down a movement and you strategize how you're going to have a movement move forward, that's a very astute tactical thing to do. To say we need,
absolutely,
just like Dr. King when he's talking about the Poor People's Campaign, because Dr. King had already proved his compassion as a man for his fellow human beings and his compassion for his people. Now, and his plea for his people of freedom struck the hearts of a lot of individuals who were non-black, who said this is a man of peace. And his point, and the point that he's making is a point of peace. So they had to listen. But also when he broke down getting ready to do that Poor People's Campaign, which would have included all poor people, that's when he became a scary force, because then you would not just have him appealing to black people, but he would have been appealing to all people. And we can only imagine how that would have turned out, to have the masses of a very diverse revolutionary force that is willing to step forward, just like Charlottesville. I mean, a lot of those kids, people fighting back, if you look at Charlottesville a couple of months ago, they seem to me, the majority to me, white kids that were standing up against the racists and the neo-Nazis. So, that was something that was not only impressive, but very encouraging for the future, that there's a whole population. You know, Trump only has, I looked at his Twitter account the other day when he said some idiotic and gave Obama a nickname, cheating Obama. But I looked, he has like 40 million followers. And then I clicked over to Barack's Twitter account. He's got 101 million followers.
So then
the election that just passed, we know there was about 120 million Americans voted in the election, leaving about roughly half, a little bit more than half of the population of this country that didn't vote in that presidential election. So that would mean to me that there's a small but enthusiastic percentage that put obviously Trump in office, right? And also the apathy that many of us had for whatever reason against Hillary Clinton, and also the Russian influence of all of the fake news coming out. The ignorance is what they thrive on, people being
and the
ignorant
statistic
and uninformed.
The statistic that you just shared with us says in a democracy that is run by majority, we have a leader who does not represent the majority, not by popular vote. And I can tell you right now, if you strip away all of the polls, and they always and this is where the media has failed, in my opinion, to properly tell the truth, because they're playing the reality game along with him, and he suckers them into a kind of a he said she said routine. Because at the point at which his polls, even if 90% of his base support him, he still only represents about 35% of the people. I don't care they say, he's a minority, and we're acting like we're totally scared of his major base, which in my opinion, if you stand up and start acting against them, because these kids and the Women's March proved without any shadow of a doubt that the galvanizing of America, we the people, have more in support against him than are in favor of him. And we need to begin to move against Congress and the state offices and the city, local city, because it's been, we the people have been silent, and we've allowed them to get, you know, take over a country. And let's face it, let's be very clear about that Sinclair Communication Group, the Mercer family, the Murdochs, and the Koch brothers, who are in control of our media. No wonder the message is being skewed, because we don't have journalism anymore. We have editorialized opinions. And unfortunately, that's what's really driving the consciousness of a country that's supposed to be a democracy. We don't have that anymore.
Well, yeah. And also, too, you know, who I think maybe Malcolm X or somebody said education was freedom, right? So when you deal with an educated populace, you have a populace first when you're beginning with a populace that's not educated and relies on their flow of information from what they read and on the internet and just in these sources where anybody can put their opinion in, you know, like you said, opinionated news. That's what happens.
Yeah.
And people rarely pay attention to the facts.
Yeah.
People rarely,
that's right.
You know, how many people actually watch these hearings that come on CNN that are available to us? How many people actually read the bills that come out and the facts?
Right.
All these people, the majority of people just kind of, you know, listen to, you know, like they talk about, people listen to their own little sounding board, their own little echo chamber, and they don't go outside. I mean, I attempt to listen at least to see the point of view that the other side is coming from, and the points that they're making. I mean, we all know the points that they're making, because they make the same ones over and over again. And we know that they're based in racism and prejudices and hate and a certain supremacy of a particular group over another group that they want to maintain. I mean, obviously, if you're a member of an advantage group, you're not going to want to give up that advantage. That's human nature. So a certain amount of it is you know, the common sense that a lot of these people claim to have, you know, that old-fashioned common sense and plain-spokenness that these people like to often refer to is really not a plain-spokenness. It's a plain-spokenness of prejudice, and it's not very much of a common sense. It's a certain perspective that they want to live and a certain life that they want to live and see projected. And our entire society, this whole country, has perpetuated this notion of a supreme race over another. And as we know, it's done in every aspect of communication almost in our society. And now we have propaganda news stations that do exactly that without any kind of just a balance, man. I mean, even so, we're coming up on 90 seconds left in the show, Byron.
Yeah, well,
I mean, we've been talking.
Well, yeah, my brother, this has been very illuminating and enlightening on this day where we celebrate and honor the Prince of Peace of the 20th century. And thank God we had him, because we are the people have been chosen to kind of keep this story moving forward. Because if we don't, it'll be whitewashed. And we already know what happened to the first Prince of Peace, who was born a homeless child, who was an immigrant, who was racially profiled. Doesn't that sound kind of familiar? 2,000 years ago, and here we are still engaged in that kind of conversation and political context. So, but there is hope
there
for
is,
the
brother.
Future.
There it
That's
is,
right.
Byron. That's it. This has been the K Thompson Live Show. Once again, I want to thank everybody for calling in. My brother Byron Saunders, our co-host. Thank you this evening, my brother.
Peace and love, always.
All right, my brother. Take care. We'll talk to you again next week. This has been the K Thompson Live Show. Once again, I am the Sun, commonly known as also Citizen Payne. And we want to encourage everybody to listen to us every Wednesday evening, 8 to 9 p.m. on Blog Talk Radio Network. Our show is also archived, so you can listen to it at any time you want. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Kay Thompson Live Show. I'm out of here. See you again next week. Bye-bye.